action.
God bless
resources. It is 1:10 in the afternoon. Mary Kapsner, co-chair Samuels, co-chair Ramirez, Representative Elkins, Representative Gatto. We're taking up HCR 9. Representative Gatto, floor is yours, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a privilege for me to talk about agriculture in the state. I was appointed by the speaker as one of the agricultural, not a chair, but certainly when we visit other communities, I like to be the representative. And now I'm going to tell you just a brief story about agriculture. My best friend's name is Jay Dearborn, and they own Dearborn Farms. His mom is Doris Dearborn. Doris is 92, and she's been farming in the valley since she was a child. Her husband has patents on various crops. They grow potatoes, they grow trees, apple trees, Siberian apples, and the whole point of this is that we do have a significant amount of agricultural development that takes place in the state, but as you may know, we consume all of it ourselves. We are not an agricultural exporter, and as such, we may not be well known throughout the country. But nonetheless, the amount of work that is put in is substantial, and I will only tell you that some farmers I know consider it a good year if they make $30,000 in the course of a year.
Speaker Harris is going to join us.
Is that right?
Part of their school project, he plays Speaker Harris.
Oh, is that right? All right.
If well, I could just interrupt you for a moment.
You're a handsome man.
Yeah. You're taller than he is, too.
And married.
Do we,
Mr. Chairman,
newly.
Isn't that Harris over there?
We have some young people that just joined us, Representative Gatto. Do we have in our, with our young people here, do we have Representative Crawford, Representative Ledoux, Representative Elkins? You're Representative Elkins?
Yeah.
Come meet your counterpart here.
This is, yeah,
here. Yes. Do we have a Representative Samuels, Representative Kapsner, Representative Gatto, or Representative Olson here? You're who? Sorry.
He doesn't have a special place here.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Gatto, please continue.
Okay, and I'll be I'll just finish up briefly. It's a $50 million industry. We're asking for a day of recognition. We had a day. It was too early in the season. When people weren't thinking agriculture, we'd like it to be the first Tuesday of May in both this year and next year, 05 and 06, in recognition of these farmers. When you go to the state fair, everybody many people visit the pavilions that have all the agricultural products, and I believe we're the better for recognizing how much work it takes in this state to produce a marketable crop that's available to the community. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll entertain questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Gatto? I have a couple of questions for you, Representative Gatto. This is for Agricultural Day, and I see that it's for this year and for next year. Representative Gatto, what if...
You're doing that to me, aren't you?
Don't do that.
A unicorn dips her beak into the ocean and all the time.
Point of order.
He always says
ready, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move HCR 9 from committee with individual recommendations and attach the general fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, HCR 9 passes.
Oh, man. Yep, next, 241.
I think we'll take 241. Yes, sir.
Okay, next up will be House Bill 241. I believe Representative Wilson is...
Is that what you're looking at?
Somebody from Representative Wilson's office here. And I see her coming around the corner right now.
Gail?
Take a brief Eddie's. We're going to hear House Bill 241. We've got seven or eight people to testify. I don't know how many in the audience have signed up yet, and we won't be moving this bill today, but we wanted to start the public testimony and discussion, and I've had the conversation with Representative Wilson before on that topic. So without any further ado, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My bill, 241, is really actually just what it says. It's a Board of Fisheries conflict of interest bill. It implements changes recommended by the Joint Salmon Task Force and to the Board of Fisheries on their conflict of interest policy. The Board of Fisheries is not as effective as it should be because of the fact that most of the knowledge and expertise that could be used in making decisions right now is conflicted out. So not only do people, when there's even a slight thought that there might be a conflict of interest, the Department of Law is very, very conservative in their recommendations on participation by members. And whenever there's even a perception of conflict, they tend to recommend members excuse themselves, and their feelings are therefore avoiding any possible litigation. Because of this, many members are not allowed to use their expertise, even when there may be just a perception of a conflict. All board members have knowledge and expertise that should be used to assist the Board of Fisheries in making the best possible decisions. And it's very much like on the floor. Us legislators, we all have expertise in certain areas. And if it's a board on real estate, well, then the representative from that area, that knows the most about it, at least gets up, mentions what his conflict of interest is, but the rest of us want to hear. We object to that because we want to hear someone that knows the facts. And that is not what happens on the Board of Fish. Not only can they not even discuss it, they can't vote on it, but they can't even discuss the subject. So what happens, there's a lot of talking that happens in the hallways and behind the workings of what's going on.
There's a bee loose behind you, but it's not close to you.
Might be attracted to your sweater, though.
But anyway, the fact is that the people that are appointed to the Board of Fisheries are appointed because they're good in certain areas. And we have people that are fishermen, commercial fishermen. We have people that are sports fishermen. We have people that are lodge owners and people that are just interested because of they like to fish. So anyway, whenever a decision has to be made, the board can't get on the record the absolute facts of the case. And so I think that's totally wrong, and that's all this bill does is say that when it comes time to discuss an issue, that the people that are the most knowledgeable in the issue should be able to discuss it and to vote on it.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. We've been joined by Representatives Olson and Ledoux. And Representative Ledoux, you had a question?
Yes. Why doesn't this equally apply to the Board of Game, all of your analysis?
Because I probably have more people in my district that are fishermen, and this, to be very simple, through the chair, this was the salmon task industry task force are the ones that decided, and they recommended this, and this is one of their recommendations, and I'm following through.
Further questions, Representative Ledoux?
No.
No. We've also been joined by Representative Crawford. Are there any other questions before we get to the public testimony? And I know somebody will bring this up, and before they do, Representative Wilson, the conversations that I've had with a lot of people on this bill as it come up is the difference is us is it's 1 in 40, and it's a lot smaller influence than 1 in 7 on the voting as far as the number of, as far as the legislators, the influence, my one vote has a lot less than the influence that one person in 7 has. So that's, I'm sure that as I look down the list of names here, you're going to hear all sides of this issue. So.
I'm sure, and I do want to make one comment. I guess what I would really like to make sure that I'm willing to hear amendments on this bill, but one thing for sure, that the expertise, the knowledge should be put on the record. That's where I'm coming from. At least get the facts on the record. Currently, we can't discuss those, and we need to have it on the record.
Okay, and are you going to be staying with us?
Yes, I'll just.
Okay.
I do have a bill in another committee, so I'm going to stay as long as I can.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll go to public testimony right now, and we're going to start with John White. And I don't know, he's off net right now. Mr. White, are you with us? Mr. White?
You want me to go?
Dr. White, sorry.
Thank you.
Put your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
My name's John White. I live and reside in Bethel. I'm a dentist. I have a limited entry salmon permit, so I commercial fish. I've been involved in regulating fisheries in the state of Alaska for about 25 years. I served 7 years on the Board of Fisheries, two of those years as its chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have the finest fisheries regulatory system in the nation. And one of the reasons it is appearances of impropriety and conflict are indeed handled so that conflicted parties do not participate in the decision-making at the table. They do, if they are conflicted out, have the right to provide public testimony, and the balance of the board then has the opportunity to question them about fisheries that they are involved in at the table like any other member of the public. So the opportunity is there to transmit information to the board. I think in the aggregate, the least damage that would occur would be to wave through and institutionalize appearances of impropriety. The Board of Fisheries is an adversarial process where one party is always trying to get fish away from another party. So there's going to be winners and losers, and it's going to create more of an air of distrust if you have conflicted parties involved in that voting, voting on these allocation proposals. The worst, I think, that could happen is that those people that are appearing before the board will be perceiving board members using kind of a shameful abuse of political power to get what they want for their own fishery. So, based upon my experience as a fisheries regulator, I'm dead set against this, and I hope you all kill it in committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. White. And I've got one question for you. Representative Wilson said that one of the goals was to just get the discussion going and to at least have the conflicted member participate in the conversation, in the debate, even if they didn't vote. And you said it's in your experience that they can do that now, or they do that now?
They are given the opportunity to testify before the board as a member of the public. Okay. And then the board members have the opportunity to ask them questions as they are seated at that time.
Okay, and as in your years as chairman, have you seen any kind of a problem with, as the chairman change, the personalities change, and the rules differ from time to time, as somebody might be conflicted out under one chairman and not under another? Have you found that to be, is that not an accurate statement or an accurate statement?
That is an accurate statement, and I think that's just a sign of good governance. Different chairs will bring different attitude to bear about this, and that's dynamic, and that's changing, just like it does in your own body. There also is the opportunity for the rest of the board to overrule the chair if somebody wishes to call that to a vote. So there are checks and balances, and I think the changing nature of the chair's discretion is a good thing.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. White. Are there any questions for Dr. White? Representative Kapsner.
I've got one. Dr. White, you sound different today. Is something wrong?
I got a cold, Mary.
Yeah, I can tell. I thought you were so passionate you were on the verge of tears. My question, though, is how much turnover is there in the board, and how much continuity is there in the board, on the Board of Fish?
Direct, that's in direct proportion to how long the governor sits but appoints board members. If it's a four-year governor, then there will be, it's calculated so that that governor will have the opportunity to appoint the full panel during their term.
So could be the case, if I might follow up, Mr. Chairman, that there is 100% turnover. I know one of the hardships in the legislature, at least in the House, is every 2 years there's a 1/4% turnover, 25% turnover. There's at least 10 members every election cycle. So that makes it very hard to feel that there's any consistency. So theoretically, with the election of a new governor, we could have an entirely different Board of Fish?
Yes, by the end of that term.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Any other questions for Dr. White? Thank you for taking time to join us today, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thank you all for your time.
Feel better.
Next, we'll go to Kenai, Paul Shadura. Are you with us, Paul?
Yes. thank you, Representative Chair Ramos and Co-Chair Samuels and members of the House Resource Committee. Please incorporate KPFA's comments on HB 241 that we presented in the House Special Fisheries Committee into your decision-making process today. KPFA feels very strongly that this bill should pass the committee without amendments. We appreciate the legislative attempts to further improve on the public process. We don't feel it is appropriate to micromanage the members on the Board of Fish at this time. It is apparent that after the public disclosure process, the governor's selection process, and the legislative committee's reviews and joint confirmation process, the potential of undue preference by individual Board of Fisheries members is very limited. The Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association and the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, representing some 1,300 Cook Inlet limited entry permit holders and holding the interest of processing, the borough and other people of the South Central fishing community, urge you to pass this bill with your positive recommendation. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Are there any other questions for Mr. Shadura? No, we're going to stay in Kenai then with Ricky Geese.
Yes, for the record, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Thank you, Chair Ramos and Co-Chair Samuels for allowing us to testify on this. For the record, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association strongly opposes HB 241. It stated that the act is to preserve and enhance the ability of the Board of Fisheries to act as a lay board. However, upon closer examination, we think this act will have the opposite effect on the Board of Fisheries process. First off, we think it's going to destroy the perception of the Board of Fisheries as an impartial decision-making body. As Dr. White said, the process often involves allocative decisions that creates winners and losers. But to have faith in this process that it's fair and impartial, the winners and losers must have confidence that when the Board of Fishery members act as arbiters, they're doing so in the best interest of the resource as a whole and not in their own personal interests. Removal of this conflict of interest provision, we think, will open up a whole can of worms, and it's going to ball up the appointment and confirmation process that you have oversight on, because we think that every interested user group and gear types will be vying to have their interests specifically vested on the board. We don't need that added weight to an already sometimes contentious process where the losers and the winners can claim that the process was somehow fixed from the start. Number two, it places power of the pocketbook over the stewardship of the resource. In general, people do not vote against their own pocketbook. The Board of Fisheries is empowered to protect the integrity of our invaluable resources here, and that stewardship responsibility can run amok if a board member is placed in the position of having to vote on matters that affect their own pocketbook. and it will call into question every vote on matters where there is a conflict of interest. The system works now, it's easy to understand, and it prevents vested interest voting by board members. Number three is we think that this will destroy the Board of Fisheries committee process, the integrity of it. The Board of Fisheries uses a committee process to organize and streamline the deliberative process of evaluation of proposals, much like the legislature does. Trying to get through all the proposals in Upper Cook Inlet this year, we had over, you know, something like 400 proposals, and the committee process streamlines the review of that. Currently, right now, in the committee process, three board members sit and review the proposals assigned to each committee and make recommendations to the full board. If HB 241 is passed, a board member with a direct financial interest could be on or even chair a committee and make recommendations to the full board. If the board member with a direct financial interest is allowed to oversight in this committee process, it creates a 1 out of 3 vote for the special interest in the committee process. All other interest groups would be placed at a tremendous disadvantage in this situation. The full board now can place a high degree of faith in the recommendations of the committee members as being in the best interests of the resource. Remove the conflict of interest provision, and this will cast doubt on every recommendation coming out of the committee process and may kill the committee process altogether, in our opinion. Currently, each of the 7 board members represents all Alaskans, and there is no disenfranchised if the board members do not vote on a proposal. As was pointed out earlier, each board member, if they do have a conflict of interest, they can testify on the public record and also participate in the committee process. So there is a manner in which their knowledge and experience can assist the Board of Fisheries in making the best possible decisions. For example, in Upper Cook Inlet this cycle, board member Mel Morris conflicted himself out of some of the Upper Cook Inlet proposals. He did go on the record, and he did put forth RCs in the deliberative process. So his knowledge and expertise was considered in the process, and he was put on record. Number four, changes to the nature of the Board of Fisheries from public service to special interest public service. So the current conflict interest provision protects the integrity of the ideal of public service. Board members are asked to serve in the best interest of the public and the resource, not in their own narrower self-interest. In a day and time when the public and media are often suspect of the political and financial motives of decision makers, why are we going to condone conflict of interest on the Board of Fisheries when board members are currently shielded from such accusations? Some may argue that it is difficult to find qualified people to serve on the Board of Fisheries in the best interest of the public and the resource. We don't feel that this is the case. Difficulty does not condone a flawed practice. It's the measure of a person of what they can do for themselves, but it's what they do in the service of others. For these reasons, we strongly oppose HB 241. Please uphold the standards of public service in Alaska and preserve the integrity of the Board of Fisheries to act as a lay board. We ask that you and other members of the House please vote against HB 241.
Thank you.
Mr. Deese?
Yes, Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have that written, your testimony that you just provided?
Yes, we submitted that to Representative Samuels early today. We faxed it to his office, and hopefully that will be included in the record.
I've got it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Geese, do you think that the person who's conflicted should be able to enter the debate at the table, even if they didn't vote? Or do you think they, right now, Dr. White testified that I assume there's a time limit, as is here, a couple of minutes to testify as a member of the public. Do you think they should be able to enter the debate at all, or do you think that things are the way they are right now or better?
We think that the way things are now is the way that they should be. I think if somebody is conflicted out of something, they do have, 3 minutes of public testimony. But then the way that it's set up now, they also there's much thorougher discussions that can happen in the committee process. And people do, board members do testify and carry along in that discussion process there. Whether you have 6 people voting on something or 7 people voting on something and going through the deliberative process, that's enough of a creative public debate and getting things on public record that we feel that we're confident in those numbers.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other more questions for Mr. Geese? Okay. Thank you for taking your time. We'll go here in the room to Jerry McCune.
Is finance started?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, and we're having a nice debate today. United Fishermen of Alaska supported this this concept, but not totally in stone. I mean, if we're not going to require them to vote and be on the record, as some chairmen have done in the past and other chairmen have not, it just depends. We need to level the playing field somehow, because like Dr. White testified, it depends on the chairman. I can own three lodges from all over the state and maybe not be conflicted out. But most of the time, commercial fishermen are going to be conflicted out. That's just a fact. And they're particularly in their fishery. So I would be willing to say that I don't think that you will hurt the process if you let a conflicted member at least discuss the issue. It doesn't necessarily have to be the head of the chair or of a committee or anything else, but at least have that member be able to put his expertise on the record and declare his conflicts out front and discuss the issue. Because a lot of the times, you know, these crab issues or different issues that come up, people have no idea about those particular fisheries, and it gives that person a chance to at least say what they feel about that issue and about how that issue is run in that particular region. So I'd be willing to go there and have that discussion if we were going to entertain any amendments to the bill, Mr. Chairman. And as far as the Board of Fisheries, the governor coming in cannot, the only thing the governor coming in is could ask everybody to resign on the board, but they don't have to resign. It staggers for the very fact, so you don't get rid of the Board of Fish. Some terms are 3 years and some are two. This year we had three members up. Next year I think there'll be two. So the Board of Fish never totally disappears every 3 year cycle that you're putting members on or off unless somebody quits or something like that. So it's designed so not everybody leaves at one time, and the governor that coming in could totally end up in his 4 year term with his appointees to the board, but not all at once. So
okay. Representative Ledee.
I've heard some discussion about maybe making a distinction between somebody who is actually actively engaged in the fishery itself as opposed to somebody who is a lobbyist for an organization or is the executive director of a fishing organization. Do you think in the context of this bill that type of distinction makes any sense?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I've seen that particular language, and it's kind of aimed at where the council is at, and not necessarily, because the depends on the appointments to the governor, and then the legislature has to confirm those people. But I don't see how a professional lobbyist would ever get on the board if you start with this body. You might be executive director or something, and you'd be quizzed pretty much, but I haven't seen that too much in the past either. In fact, the one executive director I could think of one organization didn't get confirmed, and I don't see how that provision is going to help. I think that provision is actually going to conflict more people out, because everybody comes with some kind of conflict or some kind of prejudice somewhere. I mean, you know, everybody has something in that arena, and if you narrowed it down to where they had those people were conflicted out, their executive director, or they work for a particular processor, or they work for somebody over here, I think you'd have more conflict of interest. It'd be conflict more members out, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
What do you say about the argument that I've had people on all sides of this issue come to see me here in the last week? The argument that if you let a saner on, if a saner gets to vote, then all of a sudden that commercial fishing seat, for lack of a better term, then all of a sudden the fight between the different types of gear groups, you know, you got a troller that wants it, and you got a set netter that wants it versus a drifter versus a saner versus a gill netter in Bristol Bay, that you end up infighting amongst the commercial fishermen, or you end up a governor may stack the board with different gear types saying that it's a different fishery, and that would kind of skew the balance just to try to get the votes.
Mr. Chairman, okay, I think you're...
I'm going to play devil's advocate to the next guy coming up, just so you know.
The first question would be, I guess, that if I was in a gillnet fishery and I had to make a decision on a seine fishery that was directly going to benefit that gillnet fishery, I guess that's a financial... that would be a financial conflict. And I think that still holds under... That would still hold under the present rules, even if we pass this bill. I thought that was clear in the state's conflict of interest, if it's a financial interest. I could be wrong on that. And then the second question, yeah, you would have a conflict if you were going to be the recipient of the extra whatever is going to happen, extra line or extra time or extra fish, or, yeah, you would be a recipient of that, yeah.
Okay.
And then the second question was, I can...
Just wondering if the infighting amongst the various gear types deteriorates the process in general.
Well, these appointments are all up to how the governor sees it, and, of course, there's a lot of jockeying around when the appointments or names are put in, and then it's up to the legislature. I guess if you've seen three particular members from any particular gear type, whether it's sport or commercial, I guess the legislature would have to look at that and balance that against the rest of the board if it has enough. I'm for a balanced board. I'm not for an off-balanced board. I'm for representing the subsistence, personal use, the charter, all the uses that we have. And I think that makes for a good board. No one board should be dominated by one gear group or the other.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks, Jerry. Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Carter. I'm a political consultant here in Juneau, but today I'm representing myself. I'm a former Kena River guide, guided for 10 years down there, and began attending Board of Fish meetings 12 years ago before I ever became a guide. Over those 12 years, I've attended just about every Board of Fish meeting in the area, including all of the most contentious ones, which involve Cook Inlet. I agree with the former speaker's statement that there's not been evenly applied application of this conflict and what is a conflict and what is not a conflict. Over the years, I've seen people vote on issues that they've even stated that they have a conflict, but they would claim that, well, it's only 15% of my fishery, so it's not a big decision for me. Well, I think if you, as policymakers, you need to ask yourself the question of whether or not that 15%, how many people are reasonably likely to take 15% out of their pocketbook and throw it away? And in all my years of doing it, I've never seen one person vote against their pocketbook. What I have seen is I've seen the person the instance I'm speaking of, and there's been several, but this is the one that comes to mind, they voted to move off the capes in that particular fishery and also fish another strip deeper into the water column. And their annual harvest for the 20 years previous to this decision was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2,000 and change incidentally caught king salmon. For the next 6 or 7 years after that, they went up to 25,000 incidentally caught king salmon. So while it may have been 15% of the time, I would have to go back and reflect and say, what is it today? And it would be substantially higher than that. There, what I don't want to see is this debate seems to be shaping up to where it's sport versus commercial. And while those battles have been fought in the legislature for confirmation over the years, although they've died down in recent years, we seem to be playing nicer with one another. I think if this bill does pass and does come to fruition, what we're going to see is exactly what has been stated, is that you're going to see fights from each individual gear type. And what I can see is competing commercial fisheries going after specific seats on the board because they're not being represented. And now you've got a person that can actually come in, carry the debate, with their fellow board members, like committee chairman, you're going to defer more to the people that you serve with, that you know better. You sit on that committee with them. You serve 100 days out of each year. You know them. You trust them. And why wouldn't I trust them on this decision as well? And I guess when you look at this thing and you say, well, we need to be able to bring this expertise to the table, we have a process for that. We have, I mean, government is run by people that show up. That's how it works. And when you come to the table with a bias, as Mr. McCune stated, we all have biases. But do we have a financial bias is, I think, what's in question here. Do you financially benefit from it? That's what needs to be measured. You have to have some sideboards on that as well, because from a sport fishing perspective, you could say, well, I own a restaurant, or I own a hotel in a place that's a busy sport fishing hub like Soldotna. Does that have a financial conflict? Well, that's up to the decision makers, I guess. But you know, are you actually booking fishing charters? Because you could run it right down to every T-shirt shop as well. And I guess the decision that I ask you guys to weigh is, the Board of Fish has always been one of those boards, like the Board of Game to some degree, like government in general, I think, with the general public, where the public is always suspect of whatever we come up with. And by allowing someone to have a financial conflict of interest to get up there, carry the discussion, participate in the committee process, in the committee process, there's only two people. There's only two members of the board in that committee. And while they're not actually making decisions there, they're making the foundation for the decision that's going to come later. And I guess, so we ask you, in these discussions where we have fully allocated resources, is this a step towards credibility, a step away from it? That's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I've got one question, the same question I asked before of somebody who was opposed to the bill. You still think that the debate, even at the table, adding to the debate at the table,
I think the way it works. I think the way that it works now, where the member can step aside and come up, just like I am here in front of the board members, and say his piece or her piece. And you're no different or better or worse than any other member of the public. But if you allow them to engage as a board member, you also allow them to go into the committee process and to help carry the discussion in the committee process. And as I said just a minute ago, they're not making decisions there, but they're forming the foundation for the decisions that they're going to come up with later. And I absolutely think it is a step in the wrong direction for them to be able to participate as a board member if they have a financial conflict of interest.
And currently, it's your understanding that at the committee level, they do participate.
They'll select members from the public, interested parties, and they'll have a number of committees to discuss different fisheries that we're working on at the time. And typically, it's two members from the board who carry the committee. They run the committee and operate the committee. And so I guess sitting there and thinking, yes, if somebody's in there and that's their particular fishery, whether it be a Kenai River guide or an east side set netter or somebody from Chignik, they have an expertise there that is, I guess, unparalleled with anybody else on the board. But they also have a financial conflict of interest. Now, if somebody from Chignik was participating in discussion on a fishery that was for Cook Inlet, I don't think they have a conflict.
Okay, because one of the most frustrating things as a legislator is, for me personally, is to hear a discussion on an aviation bill that I could give all sides of the argument better than anybody in this room. I can tell you why people might think I'm wrong and why might people think I'm right.
Right.
And all sides, and it's frustrating to sit on the floor, and I'm usually a little reticent to speak until I see something fundamentally shifting, a misunderstanding, and then I'll say that. So I'm just wondering, the Board of Fish, and it's a little different with seven members because your vote counts for so much more, but it's a frustrating thing to listen to a debate going on and know that Harry's off on the facts a little bit on something that he said, or it's a little frustrating to
not
try to force my opinion, but just say, look, here's my reality.
And I sympathize with that. But as it is a public process, they don't have their public process is we get up in front of a board, and they have 2-3 days of public testimony, depending on the board meeting where it's at and how hot the topics are. So you take a pile of public testimony, and then you go into the committee process, and then you debate it in committee, and then you come up, and then they start off the whole meeting with an overview from the department. And the department gives them an overview of each fishery and how it occurs, and then lots of discussion, you know, off in the halls and at breaks. There's been all kinds of stuff in the past where, you know, there was discussion about vote trading from 20 years ago and how I'll vote for you on this if you vote for me on that. And all that led to people not trusting the process. I think if you have, this is definitely in my mind a step backwards towards those days. It's not a step forward.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Carter? Thank you for taking your time today.
Thank you.
We'll go to the Matt Sue now. Larry Engel, are you with us, Larry?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Larry Engel. I reside near Palmer. I'm here to register my strong opposition to House Bill 241. And let me give you a little bit of my background so you can have a sense of perhaps why I have this opposition. I've been involved in the Board of Fisheries process for now better than 40 years. About 30 of those years, I was a fish and game staffer sitting in front of the Board of Fisheries providing technical information and listening to the discussions that went on throughout the state of Alaska. More recently, for nearly 10 years, I was appointed to and served on the Board of Fisheries, and as Dr. White said earlier, I was, like him, a vice chair and a chairman for a number of years, and therefore a supervisor in determining the ethics considerations that came before the board. And rather than be redundant, I would say, first of all, that I agree with virtually every single word that Dr. White said regarding the pros and cons of the suggested changes. I would ask each of you in the House committee to first ask, is the system really broken? Let's look at our fishery resources in the state of Alaska. When I first came to Alaska in territorial days, our fisheries were in a shambles. And in becoming a state, grasping and having a say in our fisheries was a major, major catalyst in that movement for statehood. And when the legislature first met, after becoming a state to set up a Board of Fish and Game, they wanted maximum public participation in that process, a process by which lay people were making decisions relative to the fish and game resources of the state. And that basic framework of maximizing public participation through our advisory committee system, through the actual Board of Fisheries, has essentially stayed intact for over 40 years. And the resources that the Board of Fisheries is involved in is healthy today, more healthy than certainly in territorial days, and certainly more healthy than it was 30 years ago. So some things are being done properly. The question in my mind is, do we want to risk that situation by providing greater opportunity for all board members to participate irregardless of their financial ties to the fishery? I think that we in the United States and Alaska expect our public policy decision to be fair and our views to be taken into account. I think that's true all over the country in any type of government. We expect and I think we demand that the officials hear us out and take us seriously and by all means consider our concerns fairly. And that becomes extremely hard when you've got financial interest to be considered by the regulators themselves. I reside in an area where we just went through a major concern in that regard. We had a former elected official here that took a job where he got significant financial benefit from a company that he was in the legislature was regulating, and the people took affront to that. We're just recently getting over the issues of conflict of interest and the vagaries of it in state government with the Attorney General issue. And I won't go into that, but certainly the public made it very known that they had concerns in that regard. And as much as anything, it's not whether it's the regulators or the elected officials are operating or acting improperly. It's the perception that they may be, and therein lies the problem. So to balance that concern in the arena of fisheries with any benefits that might occur from somebody be able to share their intimate knowledge and benefits through public debate on a regulatory issue and then ultimately voting on it, I don't think the benefits even come close to taking a chance for that perception of the public, particularly when you talk about a common property resource and the heated debates that occur in the fisheries arena. I think it would be a real step backwards. I might also add that in my tenure of being involved with the Board of Fisheries, either as a staff or position of Fish and Game or as a board member, that the board has come under some very serious review by the legislature, understandably, looking at ways to enhance this in the past. And lo and behold, we stick with the same basic situation. That's not to say it can't be better by making regional boards or boards of shellfish and boards of games or a paid board like we have other commissions and whatnot, but I guess in closing I would say be very, very careful. You make a this is a major change, at least in the eyes of the perception of the public. I've felt this very strongly over the years that when you hold a public office, such as a board member does, you have a major concern in maintaining public trust. And when you place financial incentives in that mix, then you're jeopardizing that issue.
Okay.
So I guess I would urge you to look very carefully at this and look at the benefits that might occur from it versus the negative aspects of it. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Engel. Any questions for Mr. Engel? That we'll move on to Petersburg. John Jensen, are you with us, John?
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman Ramirez and committee members. My name is John Jensen. I'm a commercial fisherman from Petersburg, Alaska, and also I'm presently a member of the Board of Fisheries, and I'm here in support of House Bill number 241 for the reasons stated by Representative Wilson. And that's pretty much why I'm here. I feel like I'm not getting enough input into the debates. When I have a fishery I'm involved in, I can't talk about it as much as I'd like to, especially when something comes up during deliberations that changes the whole prospect or how things are going. I can't add into it to tell them that they're going the wrong way or they're not understanding the particular fishery they're debating right. And it's real frustrating not being able to at least provide information during deliberations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for taking your time today, Mr. Jensen. Are there any questions, Mr. Jensen? Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jensen, I thought that the Board of Fish members could present testimony.
Pardon?
Have I been misunderstanding people? The Board of Fish cannot go into the public testimony?
Oh, yeah. We can provide public testimony if we know we're going to be conflicted out. And generally, there is one of the testifiers earlier said there's usually only two members in committees, but there's usually three members in the committee process, and usually if you've stated a conflict, you're not chosen to be a member of that committee for the reasons being.
But you can testify to the committee?
Yes, you can.
And you can testify to the full board, right?
Yes. Yes, right. Yes.
So you could theoretically present the same case you would as a voting member as you do as a non-voting member?
Yeah, you could.
Then can you explain to me further what your frustration is exactly?
A lot of times during debating different issues, on last year we were debating on crab, and I couldn't I could provide my testimony at the beginning of the meeting, and as soon as the crab proposal came up, I was asked to, you have to leave the board and sit in the audience. So when they're debating different issues about crabbing, for instance, I couldn't provide my expertise, even if they were getting way off track and not even working with the issue before them. It's just sort of hard not to be able to provide information that they need.
Okay, so the question is, the frustration is more with not debating.
Not correct, yes.
What I thought it was not being able to present. So I guess, I mean, not to try to make a bad bill better, but I guess one solution would be to allow for the Board of Fish membership to debate bills but not vote on them.
Yeah, that would probably add a lot to it if they could at least participate in the deliberation and keep everybody on track as far as the perspective of the fishery and my perspective also.
Okay. Representative Elkins.
Well, I'm confused by Mary's thought process. You're wanting to let them debate but then not vote on the issue? If they're on the board?
Yeah.
That's what their job is. That's why they're there.
Well, they're currently not. Well, should we reserve this, Mr. Chairman, for committee discussion?
Wait for a committee discussion on that. Okay. And we've only got a couple more of the public testifiers here. We'll stay in Petersburg with Carl Krohm.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Carl Krohm. I started fishing in 1960 on the tuna boats in San Diego. I fished as far north as Cape Denby in the Bering Sea on the herring fisheries. I fished as far south as Callao in Chile. I started when I was 20. I'm 64 now. I've been in Alaska since 1970. I've lived in Petersburg since 1970. I bought our first gill netter in 71 and our seiner in 79. We participate in the salmon seine, the salmon gill net, the salmon troll, herring seine, herring gill net, all the long line fisheries and all the crab fisheries. To start with, I'm in favor of 241, of course. And my point is mainly, the people in the legislature are never conflicted out. They are voted in there. They have all kinds of people donating to their campaigns. There's no end to the financial conflict that they would have, provided they were held to the same set of rules that the Board of Fish people are. They're not only able to deliberate and vote, they're expected to by the people that helped them get into office and by the campaign promises that they made when they got in there. All of the board members, all of the Fish and Game board members are required to pass muster with the legislature before they sit on that board. They have to be scrutinized by you guys, and you have to decide whether they're good people or bad people, whether they can be open-minded, whether they can be effective.
Did you?
Where they can be effective and open-minded and be able to vote what's right and not necessarily how their pocketbook runs. The Board of Fish this year was four sport boat people, two commercial boat commercial people, and one processor. And then one of our people was conflicted out. So then it was four against two in the voting. commercial people are very unhappy with that thing. If those people are on the board, they should be voting and they should be deliberating, as the legislature does in their issues that are before them. If they weren't good people, you wouldn't have them on there, because you scrutinize them and throw them out with the trash. When it comes to financial issues, there are people on there. I've started going to Board of Fish meetings in 1975. I represented the gillnetters from Petersburg in Soldotna, and in 76 I represented the gillnetters from Petersburg in Anchorage. I've seen many times where lodge owners who own a fleet of charter boats are deliberating and voting, even when their people are out hauling people in and out catching fish and getting paid $100 a head or wherever the hell it is they're getting paid, and they're deliberating and voting. So nobody wants to tell me that they don't vote when their pocketbook is in their mind. This board needs to be kept, we need to keep a level playing field in this board. For the last several years, it's been lopsided lopsided toward the sport fish, and it's not a level playing field anymore. These people, when they get on this board, they need to be able to vote, and they need to be able to deliberate just like the legislature does. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Crome? For the record, we've been joined by Representative Gatto and Representative Elkins, and just for the record, I'd like to say that as you say that there's a bunch of good members on the Board of Fish, I'd say that there are 40 pretty good members here that work hard and do their best and are not beholden to anybody but their conscience.
Mr. Chairman, may I follow up on that?
Representative Kapsner.
I don't have a question for Mr. Crone, but I do want to say 1/7 influence is much greater than 1/40.
Okay.
That's all.
Any comments? Okay, is there anybody else in the audience that wanted to testify on 241? No? Okay, we're going to move offline again to Gary Slavin. Are you with us, Gary? Gary?
Yes, sir. You hear me?
Yeah, I hear you now. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. My name's Gary Slavin. I'm a commercial fisherman from Petersburg. And back in ancient history in the mid-80s, I was chair of the Board of Fisheries and the joint boards when they met to do subsistence. I was also a member of the negotiating team for the Pacific Salmon Commission, and I got a lot of respect for the Board of Fisheries and the people who serve on the board, and the board's gone through a lot of changes in the last few years especially. I'd remind everyone that back in the mid-80s that we used to take everybody's conflict of interest statement on the public record at the beginning of the meeting, and then it would be up to the chair of the board and the other board members to decide how involved a particular member could get in an issue, right up to and including the debate, and then whether or not the person, whether it was appropriate for them to vote on an issue. So this, you know, this conflict of interest thing, like everything else, has evolved over the years. And, you know, when I was on the Salmon Commission, it didn't matter where I went, whether it was Canada or Washington or Oregon, everybody wanted to talk about our fish board process, and everybody was really envious about the way that Alaskan residents were able to be the third part of the, you know, of the management of their resource. And everybody understood that the department had the responsibility for figuring out how many animals could be taken or how many fish, and then the fish board was tasked and the game board was tasked with, you know, what do we do with a surplus? What's fair? And I'd remind everybody that when I was on the board, we had we had a couple of excellent board members that were sports fishermen, just 2 out of 7. And I'll never forget trying to tell those guys what a herring pound was, and how important it was to place an escape ring in the right part of a crab pot. And they in turn told me their stories about guiding sport fish, and Ernie Carter would tell me about the pictures that he used to take. But there's a lot of exchange that goes on between board members in public, as well as you know, when you're traveling, when you spend over 100 days of the winter with somebody, you get to know them pretty well. And you know their interests and what conflicts they may have. But anyway, on the issue at hand here, I don't know what the answer is on your current bill, House Bill 241, but I know that I can tell by listening to the sports fish people that they think that this current process is working pretty well for them, and I think it is probably. It's probably good, but and the current board, I think, is working real well. The reports I get from the committee meetings they have, people are pretty confident that that the board members are getting a good grasp of an issue before they make a vote, and that's the most important thing. But I just remind everybody that we're down to two or three commercial interests. It's less than half the board. And so when you do finally get to the day-to-day, you know, nuts and bolts of what that board does is decide how much net you can have and how big the mesh should be and what the right regulations are for crab pots, you really need perspective of the people who are out there, you know, doing those things. And there's nothing more frustrating than to be on the board and have the department's perspective. And when you're deliberating, the department personnel can interject thoughts and comments. And they do a good job, but it's their perspective. And if you can't get any perspective from the public, then you have to go to those committees on every issue. And there isn't anything wrong with committees. It's a great process. We used it quite a bit, but it takes up a lot of time. And there are just a lot of things that the board does from day to day that would pretty much be a slam dunk if they knew they were getting the right information from the public as they were deliberating. So I would urge you to, I know you're going to get a lot of pressure to just ignore this issue. But, you know, with the small amount of commercial participation there is on the board now and the large sport fish interest that there is on there, the issue has changed. And I think you need to seriously talk about what can we do here to allow these people to tell us at least what's real out on the fishing grounds. And if the issue comes up and they've got a significant financial interest, then of course they shouldn't vote, and it's obvious to everyone that they shouldn't vote. But I just think this blanket exclusion from the process where they basically are asked to leave the meeting it's not serving in the interest of the fish board process. And thanks for letting me on, and thanks for listening to me.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Slavin, for taking your time. Are there any questions for Gary? No? Moving on, then, we got Stephen Doherty. It says here you're representing, is it the Department of Law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Doherty. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in Anchorage.
Okay.
I'd just like to talk briefly about this bill and some of the potential amendments to the bill. First, I'd like to get on the record that the Department of Law does not consider this, and I'm certain from talking to the sponsor that the sponsor does not consider this bill to be a complete exemption from the Ethics Act for the Board of Fisheries. It allows board members with a personal or financial interest in a matter to vote after disclosure and provides that such voting is not considered a use of state facilities to benefit personal or financial interest under 3952.120b3, and is not a taking or withholding of official action in order to affect a matter in which the member has a personal or financial interest under 3952.120b4. Other provisions of the Ethics Act, including other parts of 3952.120, would still apply. Some of the provisions that would still limit board member actions include these. Those dealing with improper gifts, that's 3952.130. Improper use and disclosure of information, 3952.140. Improper representation, that's at 3952.160. Accepting, receiving, or soliciting compensation for official duties, that's 3952.120b2. Coercion of subordinates, 3952.120b5, and partisan political purposes, that's 3952.120b6. Also, the section dealing with declaration of potential violations, 3952.220, would still be partially effective. The bill would provide a partial exception from that but there would still be some disclosure required in some cases. Also under this bill, Board of Fish members would continue being able to seek advisory opinions from the Attorney General's office. And we note that this would frequently still be needed with this if the bill is adopted, even if the personal or financial interest is not going to conflict a board member out. They still may need advisory opinions regarding other issues such as gifts, and we do frequently give advice on those issues. I would also like to address the potential amendment that has been presented. There are some problems with that language. It is a narrower exception than that provided in the bill before the committee right now. It would only provide an exception if the interest directly involves activities conducted under AS 1605 or AS 1643 or sport fish guiding activities.
Mr. Doherty?
Yes.
Mr. Doherty, we don't have an amendment before us at all.
Okay. I would just point out then that at this time, the comments that I've given are applicable. But if there is an amendment, the Department of Law would have some concerns with that amendment.
Okay. Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Doherty? Representative Ledoux.
Yes, I've got a couple of questions, Mr. Doherty. Under the Act as it currently is, why is participation considered acting? I mean, has that come up in either regulations, or is there a court case or something like that? Because I wouldn't necessarily think that somebody simply participating in a discussion was acting on a matter.
Through the chair, I'm not off the top of my head, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I do know that in deliberations, the board members are trying to influence each other's opinions about what action should be taken by the whole board. And that could easily be seen as action, and I think that we have consistently interpreted an attempt to influence the board as action.
All right, thank you. Can I follow up?
Yes.
One more question? What's personal interests as opposed to financial interests?
Through the chair, personal interest is defined at AS 39.52960, number 18. Personal interest means an interest held or involvement by a public officer or the officer's immediate family member or parent, including membership in any organization, whether fraternal, nonprofit, for-profit, charitable, or political, from which or as a result of which a person or organization receives a benefit. It seems like a pretty complex definition, but basically what it boils down to is that someone who is a member of an organization that has that is impacted by a proposal before the board in a significant manner, or that has proposals actually submitted by that organization before the board, that's where we usually find a personal conflict. It's usually in a situation where an organization that someone is a member of has a proposal before the board.
Well,
yes.
Can I follow up on that? So, in other words, if somebody is, for example, a member of the United Fishermen's Association, then simply by their membership in that organization, they wouldn't be able to even discuss something before the board right now that UFA may have weighed in on?
Through the chair, I'm not certain about every situation, but there are situations similar to that where someone is a member of an organization and that organization has taken a viewpoint on a proposal before the board, and a conflict has been found in some of those situations. I don't think that it would be an across the board, there's always going to be a conflict because of someone's membership, but I do think that in some cases a conflict could be found as a result of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Olson?
Mr. Doherty, do you have a draft of an amendment in front of you right now by any chance?
Yes, I do.
I wonder if you could fax that to one of the co-chair's office, please.
This is not an amendment that was the Department of Law was proposing or anything, and it was my understanding that it was already in front of the committee. That's the reason I was addressing it.
Oh. Okay, thank you.
Hasn't been offered, may not be offered. It wasn't us. Okay, if there's any more questions for Mr. Doherty, we'll move to Fairbanks to Jennifer Uhas with the Alaska Outdoor Council. Are you with us, Jen?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Uhas. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, and I am testifying today on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council Board of Directors, representing 54 outdoor clubs and nearly 4,000 individual members for a collective membership of over 12,000 Alaskans. The Alaska Outdoor Council strongly opposes House Bill 241. Mr. Chairman, the reason our delegates and the board members from different parts of the state have opposed this language over the past several years is simple. We believe it would corrupt the Board of Fisheries process, and ultimately lead to the ruin of the resource itself. The first Alaska legislature delegated their authority to establish fisheries policy to a board of lay citizens. This system has stood the test of time. Using information from professional field biologists to base their decisions, these boards of interested Alaskans have overall done a commendable job of managing and allocating our fisheries resources. House Bill 241 proposes to replace the status quo with a system of financially interested users of public resource being allowed to vote to enrich themselves by allocating the resources to themselves. House Bill 241 allows a member of the board to vote on a proposal even if they have a financial conflict of interest. How long after a fish board member who belongs to a gear group or an area fishermen's association or a vessel owners association votes to allocate the public resource to their benefit before another group says, hey, let's get our guy on the board? At that point, we don't have a fish board, as we've known it since statehood. We have a board of fish lobbyists. Mr. Chairman, I followed the deliberations of this committee for several years. I've staffed this committee. I know that you hear an extraordinary range of resource issues and do a pretty fair job of it. One thing I've never observed this committee do well, however, is allocate fish or game resources. It's no secret why the legislature has delegated that task to the boards. If House Bill 241 passes, there's no doubt in my mind that you'll be back in the allocation business. When resource users no longer trust the board because the system is corrupt, and it's corrupt because the members all have conflicts, where will they turn? They'll turn to you, and the various sides will always have a sympathetic ear somewhere in this building. You'll be sitting here slicing the pie when you could be growing the pie and letting the board slice the pie. Proponents of this bill have brought the argument that the legislature gets to vote when they have a conflict, so why shouldn't the fish board? The answer is simple. Legislators are elected to a specific district within the state. If a legislator were not allowed to vote, people in that district would be left unrepresented, and our system is based on equal representation. The current arrangement of a legislator declaring a conflict, but then being required to vote by the rest of the body, accommodates the need for disclosure, so the public is aware of a conflict or potential conflict, yet allows people in that legislator's district to be represented. This is quite different from the Board of Fisheries, members of whom are not chosen to represent a specific district or area, but the whole state. If one of them is not allowed to vote, there are six remaining members. Mr. Chairman, we've also heard the charge that the board members with a personal use fisheries background have been allowed to vote on issues which they've had a conflict, while board members with commercial fish background have been forced to recuse themselves. This is simply not the case, and the tape records of the Board of Fisheries meetings prove it. Go back and listen to the tapes of the board meetings. There have been plenty of members with a personal use background who have sat out of board discussions. We have also heard the need to clarify the rules under which the board members serve. This is something we would like to see from the Department of Law, and I strongly recommend that the committee insist that the Department of Law be held to the responsibility rather than be coerced into doing it for them. In closing, Mr. Chairman, when we consider the system we have now, a system that has produced a lot of success stories, we want to elevate the fish board. We believe we should raise the standard, make it something people look up to and trust, and not lower the bar so it's easier for some people to step over. The Alaska Outdoor Council opposes House Bill 241 and urges that you hold this legislation in committee. Thank you.
Okay, and any questions for Jennifer? Jan, could you, if that testimony is in writing, could you get it to my office?
I always do.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else online that we've missed? Is there anybody else in the audience that still wishes to testify?
Ben Levengood was here in Fairbanks. He had to excuse himself. He ran out of time. And Tom Scarborough is present here in Fairbanks, Mr. Chairman.
Then we'll take Mr. Scarborough's testimony.
He's shaking his head.
Okay. Okay. Then we'll close public testimony right now. Representative Wilson, we're going to hold the bill over as we discussed earlier. If you'd like to make some closing comments or at...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make some closing comments, and I think that maybe everybody would feel more comfortable if we could just make sure that everybody was treated the same, and I think that's the crux of the whole thing. That does not always happen, and it changes, as you heard, with depending who the chairman is, and that shouldn't be. It should be exactly the same, and everybody should have to live by the same rules, and that's not what's happening, and so that's the real problem here, and if we can figure out how to fix it, I'm very open to hearing that, because that's what this is all about.
Okay. Representative LaDue.
Is there any other alternatives that you can think of, Representative Wilson, to fix it? Because I'm listening to this testimony, and it almost sounds like, you know, that no member of the Alaska Outdoor Council, for example, would be allowed to act on a board of fish matter just by virtue of having a personal interest, according to what Mr. Daugherty was saying about personal interest.
But they do. So that's not the case.
Okay. With that, we'll hold 241 over and move on to 269. I need to excuse
hold on
okay.
for maybe a fix. Is that what we're holding it over for?
Huh?
Okay.
Pardon me?
Are we holding this over to maybe fix it, or?
We're holding it over to contemplate. All right, we're going to take up House Bill 269. Jay Pearson is here to present, and we're going to try and get through this before end of committee today. Jane, go ahead, please.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramos. House Bill 269 deals with fixing the uncertainty caused by the United States Supreme Court's December 24th decision in Cooper Industries versus Aviel Services. Alaska's hazardous substance remediation statutes are modeled after the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act of 1980, CERCLA, and the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Acts of 1986, SARA. The U.S. Supreme Court found in the Aviel decision that a responsible party cannot bring a contribution action until such time as the party has been sued by the state or federal government or has entered into a formal administrative settlement of liability agreement. The Aviel decision puts into question the rights of Alaskans who conduct voluntary cleanups on properties contaminated by hazardous substances to undergo contribution actions against other potential responsible parties. Voluntary cleanups of contaminated sites form the vast majority of environmental cleanups conducted in the state of Alaska. These voluntary cleanups allow the state to focus its limited resources on monitoring responsible party cleanup actions instead of undertaking costly administrative or judicial enforcement actions or forcing cleanups or undertaking cleanups at the public's expense. The right to contribution actions against other potentially responsible parties creates an important incentive for voluntary remediations by allowing responsible parties to undertake effective cleanups themselves and then to be able to recover some of those costs from other potentially responsible parties who fail to voluntarily undertake the cleanups or assist with the cleanups. The purpose of this bill is to respond to the Aviel decision by clarifying the language in Alaska Statute 46.03822J, ensuring that responsible parties who conduct voluntary cleanups may bring contribution actions against other potentially responsible parties, whether they are sued by the government or not. House Bill 269 has the support of both the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Governor's Office. This is not an area of law where Alaska can afford to have the common law decisions of the court outpace our codified laws. For the reasons stated above, I strongly urge the committee to pass House Bill 269.
Any questions for Jane?
Chairman, I wish I could form a good question. I'm still not sure, in practical terms, what this does. If you could just work on it for a little while and somehow or another bring me up to speed.
If you have a gas spill on your property, mm-hmm. it's now you have a contaminant on your property. You undertake to clean it up, but you weren't the one who spilled the gas. The person who owned the property before you spilled the gas.
Okay.
What's happened is the Supreme Court has made a decision that you cannot sue that person to recover your cost until such time as either the federal government or a state government instigates a suit. So you're kind of out of luck as far as instigating an action to recover your costs, even though you weren't responsible. So all this does is it changes our statutes so that once the state has identified or the federal government has identified other responsible parties, you have the right to sue them for their part in the spill. And it doesn't involve the state having to make a suit or the federal government having to make a suit. It can be handled privately.
Excellent. Thank you. Jane, can you go up to finance? They're ready. They just sent a note down there. Ready to have somebody call upstairs and tell me you're on your way. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Fast-moving bill.
Oh, I'm available.
Run it right up there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Ben, do you want to come up?
Yes. Please? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Benjamin Brown, the legislative liaison for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Larry Dietrich, the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, would have been a far superior person to myself to make comments regarding the department's position on the bill to you, but he's unfortunately not available today. So I have the pleasure of being here instead. And Mr. Tostevin, our Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law, is vastly more knowledgeable about this than I am. But very briefly, because it is somewhat confusing, Representative Crawford's question, I think, you know, made that point pretty clear. The United States Supreme Court kind of came down in an odd way in the Cooper Industries versus Aviel decision. And they very, very strictly interpreted the statutory language of the federal CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, and said, well, unless you have a right to a contribution action under this section or this section of the act, first section being you have been the defendant in a suit, named defendant in a suit by the federal government or state government, then you can't go after a third-party defendant. And the department didn't seek to have this, this was not introduced as a governor's bill because we don't have a problem right at the moment because the Alaska Supreme Court has not had a case come before it and been given an opportunity to issue a decision similar to the United States Supreme Court and Cooper Industries. We would hope that our state Supreme Court would never do anything like that, but our attorney, Mr. Tostevin, and he'll speak to this in a moment, kind of advised us that, well, if the state Supreme Court were to come down the same way the federal Supreme Court did, it would be quite a problem. The potential fiscal impact would be that we would have to draft up complaints and hail parties that had undertaken voluntarily to clean up sites into court just to give them the ability to seek contribution from another party. And since they're already voluntarily cleaning up, that would not be the best use of the Department of Environmental Conservation or the Department of Law's resources. So the bill will foreclose the possibility of a future problem based on this kind of arcane interpretation by the United States Supreme Court. So DEC does support the bill. It's good policy, and I would be happy to answer questions, but as I said a moment ago, I think Mr. Tostevin knows a good deal more about it than ever I will.
Thank you, Ben. Are there any more questions for Ben, or can we hold you here? For
I'm happy to stay here. I told your staff I would remain until the end of the hearing.
Thank you. We appreciate that
Thank
very
you,
much.
Chairman.
Let's go to Mr. Tostevin, who's with the Department of Law. Are you with us, Mr. Tostevin?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes. Do you have a presentation to make, or would you like to field some questions?
I have a very short overview I could give you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, please.
All right. Well, for the record, my name is Breck Tostevin. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law. I've represented the state in connection with oil and hazardous substance cleanups for the past 15 years. As Ben Brown stated earlier, the administration and DEC and the Department of Law supports House Bill 269. And the reason we support it is because it ensures that Alaska's system for conducting environmental cleanups will continue as it has in the past, but without us having to incur additional costs or enforcement actions or have to bring lawsuits against people simply to allow them to have a right of contribution against other people who are liable on the statute. What the bill does this by clarifying the ability of people who conduct voluntary cleanups to recover their costs from other responsible parties under the statute. This right to recover costs from other liable persons is known as the right to contribution. And the bill ensures the right to contribution exists even if a person conducting the cleanup hasn't been sued by the state or the federal government. House Bill 269 would remove uncertainty and confusion that was caused by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in the Cooper Industries versus Avial case. In Avial, the Supreme Court found that under CERCLA, which is the federal statute upon which our statute was patterned, that a responsible party couldn't bring a contribution action unless they had been sued by the state or the federal government or enter into a formal administrative settlement with those parties. Now, this requirement of a lawsuit or a formal settlement with the state before a responsible party can bring a contribution action is not consistent with what our Alaska Supreme Court has done in interpreting our statute. For example, in the FDIC versus Laidlaw case, the Alaska Supreme Court recognized that responsible parties could bring a contribution action in the absence of a lawsuit by the state. They found that an administrative action by DEC, if a person then went and proceeded with a voluntary cleanup, was enough to allow an action under 822. The concern is if the Alaska Supreme Court did follow the Avial decision, that would throw a great chaos and a monkey wrench in the entire voluntary cleanup process that we have going in Alaska. So what House Bill 269 would affirm the result in the FDIC versus Laidlaw case by allowing a contribution action after the issuance of a potential liability determination by DEC. And the bill defines what a, quote, potential liability determination is in Section 3 of the bill, which is in lines 6 through 16. And it defines those things in terms of DEC's existing practice. Determinations, for example, would include a letter notifying a person that the person is a potentially responsible party. Well, we refer to those as PRP letters. Another example would be a notice to the person of state interest in a release or a threatened release of oil. DEC's emergency response program often issues those in response to a catastrophic spill or a vessel spill. So those are two examples of what a potential liability determination is. And upon receiving that, a person who conducted a voluntary cleanup would then have the right of contribution under 822J against other persons liable under the statute for that incident. Clarifying these results would encourage voluntary cleanups in the future. To do otherwise would punish those who have actually cleaned up property in the past and would reward recalcitrant parties who failed to take action while others have spent money in their place. So in conclusion, we would support this clarification to the law to ensure that there isn't confusion and uncertainty in the future and ensure that the process proceeds as it has done in the past. And I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Tostevin. Are there questions for Mr. Tostevin? Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who would be the opposition to this bill? Are there any specific parties out there that are going to come out against this bill?
Well, through the chairman, none that I know of. I mean, there could be a class of folks who haven't done cleanups in the past, but frankly, under you know existing Alaska Supreme Court precedent, they would be subject to a contribution action now.
Follow up?
No.
Any other questions for Mr. Tostevin? All right. If you could hang in there for us, please, sir, we'd sure appreciate it.
Certainly.
We'd like to go to George Lyle now. Mr. Lyle, if you could identify yourself and where you're calling from and who you're representing.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Please.
This is George Lyle. I'm a private attorney in Anchorage with the law firm of Guess and Rudd, and I'm here today on behalf of several of my clients who are generally property owners. The properties in many cases have been contaminated with some type of petroleum product, often heating fuel from 20 or 30 years ago. And because Alaska has a strict liability system for responsibility for hazardous substances, including oil, they have had the obligation as the current owner to clean up those properties. The statute, however, also gives them the right, we thought before Avial, to go after the parties who actually caused the contamination and to seek equitable contribution from those parties. So my clients are trying to put a very real face on this. These are business people. These are people who inherit property. For any of a variety of reasons, they end up with property, and as the current owner, they're usually the target from the DEC for the cleanup. And in most cases, we try and have them cooperate in performing this cleanup with the understanding that they could eventually seek recovery from others who are also responsible. What we found after Avial is that we're actually getting, in one case, a settlement withdrawn by a party saying, we don't think we're responsible anymore because of the Avial decision, that you can't bring a claim against us for contribution. So not to address any of the technical aspects of the bill, we did work with the Attorney General's office on this, and we support it. My clients support it. However, there is a very human, personal element of this for my clients who have spent, in many cases, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, dealing with these problems, cooperating with the DEC, and would like to see this legislation passed to prevent their opportunity to recover some of those costs in an equitable manner from the people who actually caused the problem. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee or the chair may have.
Thank you, Mr. Lyle. Are there questions for Mr. Lyle? Mr. Lyle, we appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. There's no questions here from the committee. You're welcome to stay online as we obviously there's nobody here in the room that wants to testify. So we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. Do you have anybody else? All right, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. Is there a committee discussion about HB 269?
Yeah, would you entertain a motion to move House Bill 269 and attach fiscal notes out of committee?
I will in one moment. I appreciate that, Representative Olson. Representative LeDux, did you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to say that since I'm one of these terrible trial lawyers, that I certainly am not going to object to, you know, anybody suing anybody for contribution. So,
very, very thoughtful, Representative LeDux. And just as an aside, we had those kids that were in here from the legislative. One of them was Representative LeDux, and I was asked how to pronounce her name properly. So, all right, Representative Olson.
I move that we. I'll make a motion that we move House Bill 269.
Thank you. Any objections? Seeing none, HB 269 passes, and it is 2:45, and we are adjourned.